is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. A growing number of African Americans are moving to the right. Why? And what does this mean for America? On the program today, we'll look at the history and evolution of black conservative thought. Our guest is Christopher Allen Bracey, a Washington University law professor. He is the author of Saviors or Sellouts, The Promise and Peril of Black Conservatism, From Booker T. Washington to Condoleezza Rice. Bracey says, quoting here, "Conservatism has become a credible and compelling alternative to traditional liberal modes of political, cultural, and economic empowerment." Listeners, you're invited to join the discussion this afternoon with a phone call. We look forward to your questions and comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. Christopher Allen Bracey is a professor of law and of African and African-American studies at Washington University in St. Louis. Professor Bracey is a graduate of Harvard Law School, where he served as supervising editor of the Harvard Law Review and as a general editor for the Harvard Civil Rights Newsletter and the Harvard Black Letter Journal. Christopher Bracey's book, Saviors or Sellouts, The Promise and Peril of Black Conservatism, From Booker T. Washington to Condoleezza Rice, is published by the Beacon Press. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Professor Bracey, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. This is a very fascinating, very interesting topic. And you begin the introduction to Saviors or Sellouts by telling readers that you've been asking this question for a number of years now. What exactly does it mean to be a black conservative, and why would anyone choose to become one? How do people respond when you ask?
Yeah, you know, I've gotten a variety of responses to that question. Some people, look at me strangely, as if I should already know the answer to that question on some level. But unfortunately, I'm not a black conservative, so I don't know intuitively what is appealing about it. Other people get angry when I ask the question because they're defensive about their politics and would prefer not to share that with me. A lot of people look at me sort of accusatorily, thinking that I'm up to something. I'm trying to smoke them out, as it were. And it's always been a sort of an interesting exchange, but never one that I found sufficiently compelling or satisfactory.
Yeah. Now, what led you to ask the question?
Well, I was responding in part to what I perceived to be as a growing perception that black conservatism was gaining momentum in black America. I mean, I started thinking about the most prominent figures, and this was back in 2006, the summer of 2006 when I began this project. So I started thinking about the most prominent African-American figures and leaders at the time, and names like Colin Powell, Condoleezza Rice, and Justice Clarence Thomas came to mind, and they're all conservatives. At the time, Michael Steele, who was lieutenant governor of my home state of Maryland, had announced his intention to run for the United States Senate as a Republican. And there were others like, Pittsburgh Steelers wide receiver Lynn Swann, who had announced his aspirations to run for the governorship of Pennsylvania as a Republican. And, I'm an academic, and so I'm constantly looking at, the most recent writings on American race relations. And they were all written by conservatives: John McWhorter, Shelby Steele, Thomas Sowell. Juan Williams, enough, is another example of that. So then I started nosing around in the blogosphere, looking to see what, young, politically active African-Americans were talking about. And I found this growing but vibrant sector in the blogosphere of black conservatives, Booker Rising, the Conservative Brotherhood, the New Underground Railroad. And it was this whole world that was existing, I became curious that, there was all this action and momentum going on. And then, of course, you see Bill Cosby in 2004 come out with his critique of what he perceived to be as destructive cultural practices of urban blacks, and then Chris Rock doing the same thing. And it began to crystallize in my mind that, there's something here worth talking about.
Yeah. Well, your investigation and your research, has it led you to reconsider your ideological outlook?
Well, you know, I'm not so sure that it has that reflexive moment for me. But, you know, one thing is for sure, you know, here I'm in the book, I don't talk about Republicans or Democrats. I'm talking about, you know, liberals and conservatives. And you know, in some respects, what we see, at least with this growing trend of conservatism within Black America, is a large historical tradition of conservatism. And it suggests that, you know, there's a little bit of conservatism even among the most progressive of us, right? So, you know, for me as a self-proclaimed progressive, there are aspects to my politics that map on to the sort of conservative tradition that has existed in America since the founding of the Republic.
Hmm. What is the appeal of conservatism for African Americans?
Well, you know, I think, you know, what you have to do is look at it at a particular historical moment. You know, if you look back in the early 19th century, what was attractive about conservatism then would be something very different than what is attractive about conservatism in the early 21st century. So I would say that, you know, the best way to approach this is to ask, you know, what period are we talking about, and then go into a more specific question about what Black conservatism means in that particular period, because that will tell you what is attractive about it. So the 21st century, let's do the modern era, because, you know, that's probably most compelling to people. You know, I always say that if you want to be the architect of your own destiny, and if you're weary of victim status and being the perennial object of charity, then you're probably going to be attracted to conservative ideology because it promotes this idea of self-reliance and independence and self-determination. If you think, for instance, that self-help and self-reliance are the strongest pathway to achieve a level of dignity and respect, then you're going to be attracted to conservative Black conservatism and Black conservative ideas. If you're relentlessly individualistic, if you're tired of being viewed through the prism of group affiliation, then you're probably going to be attracted to Black conservatism. And if you've got more money and wealth, right, if you're middle class or upper middle class, then chances are you'll be attracted to conservative ideas. Yeah. And the list goes on.
Yeah. Well, speaking of the 21st century, early in the book you mention two politicians, very interesting people, Barack Obama and Deval Patrick. They are aware of the growing power of Black conservatives. How are they reaching out to this constituency?
Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting. I mean, Barack Obama in particular has demonstrated a real awareness that Blacks are not a sort of monolithic liberal contingent, and that one has to acknowledge the internal complexities within African-American voters, and that there are some real conservative strains there, particularly when it comes to family and religious values. And so if you look at exit polling for Barack Obama in particular, you will see that he polls quite strongly among voters who claim to attend church at least once per week. And so, you know, Obama is very smart about doing that. He's gone as far to openly court Republicans, moderate Republicans, and he likes to call them Obamacans. Right, and so he has his own discourse, a way of reaching out and transcending partisan lines, and in many ways, both he and Deval Patrick represent post-partisan politics, right, where we no longer have to go by traditional party lines, and we can ask more important and intelligent questions about issues.
So, do you see a shift in the partisan landscape due to figures like these two fellows?
Well, you know, I'd like to think that we'll see a shift in plate tectonics in the partisan landscape. You know, I'm not sure that one or two people are going to be enough to destabilize this partisan regime. But, you know, one thing is clear, both of them are attracting people across party lines, and they both represent, I think, the future of American politics, which is a much more complex, nuanced, issue-oriented politics in which people advance or ascribe positions that are some conservative, some liberal, some moderate. They don't map neatly onto the traditional Republican-Democrat paradigm, and yet their political position perfectly represents who they are as individual thinkers.
Yeah, kind of a new generation.
Yeah.
On All Things Considered, on Friday evening, this was February 15th, a few days ago, Melissa Block interviewed a congressman from Missouri, a member of the Congressional Black Caucus. His name is Emmanuel Cleaver. He's endorsed Hillary Clinton, and his district, though, has voted for Barack Obama. And there's another congressman, at least another congressman, in the same spot, John Lewis.
Mm-hmm.
What does one do? Remain loyal or reflect the desire of your constituency? And how do the older generation Democrats deal with the newer generation? And, you know, what's going on?
Yeah, you really put your finger on a big problem that's beginning to surface. You know, with half the CBC pledging their superdelegate votes to Hillary Clinton, and the districts now turning, the sort of popular vote turning, these officials are in a real bind. But more importantly, they're beginning to be exposed. I mean, I actually had a student come in my office today wanting to talk precisely about this issue, and John Lewis in particular. And he says, you know, what does John Lewis stand for? You know, should John Lewis represent the will of his constituency, or is he entitled to, you know, take a partisan view based upon, you know, past relationships with the Clintons as dispositive of where he should cast his delegate vote? And I told the student, it's complex, and this really is a generational shift. And, you know, this is the way it works in politics, you know. These are dynasties that have life cycles, and, you know, we're in a period of transition. I don't think it's a sort of catastrophic moment within the Democratic Party or among liberals. I think this is an exciting moment. It's an opportunity to really embrace the prospects of transformation and change after the Bush administration.
Yeah, it also gives us a new way to look at color, the issue of color.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You know, I think that one of the most interesting things that has happened, you know, from a race relations law perspective with this whole campaign and the mixing of the class issue, mind you, as well, is that, you know, America has gotten a lesson on racial politics, the relative unimportance of race in certain respects, and yet the importance of racial identity when it's self-ascribed. For Barack Obama choosing to openly affiliate with African Americans but not be captured by race politics, right? And then you have sort of old line Democrats who claim to speak on behalf of the African American community, and then they back Hillary Clinton. It's just sort of an interesting, you know, complex narrative about the absurdity of race in American political culture.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Christopher Allen Bracey. He is the author of Saviors or Sellouts: The Promise and Peril of Black Conservatism, from Booker T. Washington to Condoleezza Rice. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with a question, a comment. Join the conversation with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Well, the book's subtitle suggests an upside and a downside to this. What are the strengths and weaknesses of Black conservatism?
Well, you know, what's interesting is, you know, what I try to say in the book, and this is a point that I emphasize repeatedly, is that neither liberals nor conservatives have the silver bullet when it comes to racial empowerment for African Americans in particular. All right, if that were the case, then we would see one group dominate all the time, and yet there has been this ebb and flow over the years. And in fact, Black conservatism was the dominant mode of political engagement for the first 150 years of sort of Black political activism in this country. You know, there are upsides and downsides. I mean, one of the great virtues of Black conservatism is this instinct towards self-definition, right, to sort of take command of one's own life and lead a self-determined life. Also, what is interesting about it is that, you know, Black conservatism provided for economic stability, cultural stability, at a time in which the status of Blacks in American life was exceedingly fragile. Now, here I'm talking about just after the Civil War, when you have newly emancipated slaves, right, trying to make their way through the pathway towards citizenship and becoming full American citizens. The status of Blacks was exceedingly fragile. It was this conservative political philosophy that ensured the longevity of Black people, so that in the early part of the 20th century, when the law began to take shape in a way that created opportunities for Black political advancement, Blacks were able to avail themselves of the liberal legal alternative. All right, so conservatism provided the means by which Blacks could survive and sustain themselves during that dark period of American history. the liberal legal alternative, right, though, did something that black conservatism never did, which was it provided for a massive bestowal of rights-based protections. And although largely symbolic initially, it's those rights-based protections that have ensured the longevity and flourishing, human flourishing of black Americans throughout the 20th century and into the 21st. Mm-hmm. So there are pitfalls and possibilities associated both with black conservatism but also liberal thought as well.
Yeah. Let's take a call now. A listener in Eureka, Illinois, line 4. Hi.
Hello. An interesting conversation. At the mention of Shelby Steele, I remember one interview I heard with him on WGN and another one when he talked on Book Notes, and he used a word to describe Barack Obama, but I can't remember exactly, but I think it's something like he's not a divider, and it's something that appeals to whites, and he tried to explain why so many white people seem to be joining in his coalition. I think the book was a book's name, Why Barack Obama Can't Be Elected President, or something to that effect. Could you comment on that, please?
Sure, yeah, I think the concepts you're talking about, what Shelby Steele did in his most recent book on Barack Obama was divide black politicians into two categories. One he called bargainers. I think that's the term that the caller is referring to.
Yes, I believe that's right.
Yeah, yeah. So one is the bargainer, and he said that bargainers tend to not brush institutions against the grain, right? They sort of accept the status quo. They work within the existing structure, and that they tend to do better among whites, right? And they tend to sort of they're able to obtain incremental gains. And then he contrasts Barack Obama to what he perceived as challengers. And in the challenger category, he placed, the Al Sharptons and the Jesse Jacksons. And it's unclear what Shelby Steele was trying to do there, except, to suggest that maybe, that Barack Obama is not this massive change agent that we think he is. I for one seem to, I subscribe to the view that, Barack Obama's candidacy really does mark a radical transformation in American presidential politics. But I guess what Shelby Steele is arguing is that it's not that big of a deal, that he's no different than any other bargaining politician that has come along in the past. And so we can't expect a sort of massive transformation to take place, under his watch. But at the same time, it's unclear whether Shelby Steele is saying that he prefers challengers. I think what Shelby Steele is saying is that there's a sense in which both of these people, both of these types of leaders, have their virtues and vices, and that maybe he wants to engage in a critical examination of Obama. But what I would say is, the more interesting question is to ask, well, where do the Shelby Steeles come out? Where do the black conservatives like Shelby Steele, Thomas Sowell, and others, where do they come out in terms of their politics? Are they more inclined to support Barack Obama because he's able to reach across and transcend partisan lines and embrace some of that conservative tradition that they embrace, or are they likely to not support any liberal candidate?
Could I ask one more question, please?
Sure.
What's your opinion of Thomas Sowell? I guess I know he's a conservative, you said, and I think he's primarily rights on economic issues.
Yeah, mm-hmm. He's a conservative economist. That's exactly right. And, he's profiled in the book, Saviors or Sellouts. He's one of the people who I point to as providing the intellectual grist for black neoconservatism, this sort of new ultra-right-wing black conservative ideology that has captured the academic institutions and the think tanks but doesn't really get a lot of expression in the public sphere. It gets watered down for public consumption. But Thomas Sowell is one of these guys who's been around a long time writing about these issues, and he's always critiqued affirmative action. He tends to sort of take a very hardline stance against government intervention in the name of promoting racial progress. He is in many ways the forefather of a lot of what you read by black conservatives, including John McWhorter and Shelby Steele and others.
This portion of the black spectrum, they would only represent, what, 10% of blacks?
Well, you know, it's probably, you know, it's unclear whether they have a native constituency, as you're suggesting. I mean, one of the things that I talk about in the book is the fact that many of these black conservatives, these black neoconservatives, are propped up by inorganic constituencies, meaning or constituencies that do not include African Americans. Their funding is provided largely by external ultra-right-wing conservative think tanks that are predominantly run or operated by white Americans. They are writing pieces that appeal, by and large, to, you know, ultra-right-wing white conservatives. They're not operating within the black community in the way that traditional black conservatives did. You look to a Booker T. Washington as an example of a black conservative who was empowered, nurtured, and sustained, by and large, by the black community. Thomas Sowell, Shelby Steele, and John McWhorter, these are guys that operate external or outside of the black community, and their salaries are paid for, by and large, by white donors. So is there appeal of, do they appeal to 10% of the black population? It may be lower than that. Who knows? I mean, they're not public officials, so we don't really get a sense of, you know, how grand their appeal is. But one thing's for sure is that their ideas become translated in public life by folks like Justice Clarence Thomas or Colin Powell or Condoleezza Rice. And we see popular expression of these same sentiments by Bill Cosby and Chris Rock. And so their ideas take on a life of their own beyond their intellectual framework. And so the larger question is, what number of African-Americans today would count themselves as conservative in a way that is somewhat consistent but not entirely coterminous with these ultra-right-wing black conservatives? And I say that number is probably around 30%.
Would you describe them as bargainers or challengers?
I think that, you know, for these sort of ultra-right-wing black conservatives, I don't think that they're bargainers at all. I mean, I think that they are challengers, you know, in a very classic sense. And you know, what's interesting is that there is this connection between sort of liberal or radical challengers, right, like in the Black Power movement, and black conservatism, right? So both attempt to take, you know, hardline stances against the status quo, right? I mean, both are arguing that we don't need government intervention, that, you know, we should allow blacks to determine their own fate and pursue their own lives with integrity and dignity and respect, right? You know, they both say, for instance, that we shouldn't endorse affirmative action, that that actually undermines, the credibility of black leadership and so on and so forth. These are positions that are challenging positions because they're challenging the liberal status quo now. And they did so in the 60s, you know, with the Black Power movement, challenging the liberal status quo.
Yeah. Well, let's go back to the civil rights era, maybe, and then we'll flash forward to the Fairmont Conference, where we bump into Thomas Sowell in your book. Chapter 5, Black Conservatism in the Civil Rights Era, the subtitle of this chapter, Why the Nation of Islam, Elijah Muhammad, Malcolm X, and Stokely Carmichael's Black Power Movement are part of the black conservative tradition. You want to give us an overview of that?
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, this is an extension of sort of an earlier argument that's developed in the previous chapters. And, you know, basically what happens at the turn of the 20th century, early 1900s, you know, black conservatism is at its height. Booker T. Washington and the Washingtonians, immensely popular. The NAACP has yet to arrive on the scene. Soon the NAACP would arrive and displace black conservatism as, and liberal thought would displace black conservatism as the dominant mode of political engagement for African Americans. But black conservative ideas, right? Remember, this book is in some ways a history of ideas. These ideas would remain and circulate in various aspects of our American culture and would pop up in the most unlikely places. And one of those places that it popped up in the 1920s was in the Marcus Garvey Back to Africa movement. Right. When you look at Marcus Garvey and you read his autobiography, you'll find that Marcus Garvey himself admits to essentially replicating Booker T. Washington's philosophy for black empowerment, a sort of segregated network of institutions run by and accountable to African Americans. Right. And the idea was that, you know, blacks should be able to determine their own destiny, have their own corporations and so on and so forth. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it turns out that that basic conservative idea that informed the Back to Africa movement would be resuscitated during the Civil Rights Movement by the Black Power movement, Stokely Carmichael. And here I'm not talking about the Black Panther Party. I'm talking about the Black Power movement, the student-oriented movement, in which Stokely Carmichael began to sort of repeat some of these basic notions of black conservatism, you know, self-reliance, independence of thought, freedom from government intervention, which at that time always meant that there was something catastrophic going on, right? Being relentlessly forward-looking, pragmatic, and optimistic about things, that sort of thing. The Nation of Islam is another example of black conservative thought. I mean, you know, one of the things that I talk about in the first chapter of the book is the idea that black conservative thought was rooted in Christian evangelical teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And so it really talked about the importance of leading a morally upright and chaste lifestyle, just sort of a politics of respectability. And that politics of respectability was the centerpiece of the Nation of Islam. The idea that Muslims didn't smoke, Muslims didn't drink, Muslims took care of their family, they were respectful of women. And there was one other important feature of the Nation of Islam that maps on very closely to early black conservative thought, and that was a profound deference to Western institutional authority. Right? Black conservatives in the early period didn't challenge Western institutions of government and so on and so forth. That was also true for the Nation of Islam. One of the central teachings of the Nation of Islam was that you don't challenge the government. And that was true even under Malcolm X. You know, you didn't see the Nation of Islam marching in the civil rights movement. They never took on the police. They never took on institutions. They always ignored Western institutions and all of the ills of Western society in service of a greater overarching moral and cultural aspiration of creating a morally upright and respectable black community.
Mm. I want to ask you to talk about another figure that you write about quite a bit in Saviors or Sellouts, and he's a very interesting fellow. George Samuel Schuyler, I believe, is how you pronounce his name. He went from socialism to conservatism. What a journey did he make? How did he find his way to conservatism? How was he at first a socialist?
Yeah, I mean, this is one of my favorite chapters of the book, in part because he does make this remarkable journey. You know, George Schuyler grew up in upstate New York in a predominantly white neighborhood, and, you know, it was a household that really subscribed to traditional black conservative values, you know, religious fervor. They had Bible readings at night that were led by his grandmother. You know, the house was always neat. His father was a chef, which was a big deal back then. And so he was a respectable citizen. And, you know, Schuyler was brought up to be a respectable citizen, much like the rest of his family. He ran into some problems, and eventually found himself hanging out with some socialists at Syracuse, and then he runs into A. Philip Randolph, you know, who brings him on board as a writer for The Messenger, and gives him a column, Shafts and Darts, where George Schuyler begins to sort of gain a voice, and he starts critiquing things. And, you know, at first it's just sort of, it's almost like humor. It's like satire.
Mm-hmm.
It's not real heavy-handed conservative ideology, right? It's just critiquing whatever is out there, you know, taking pot shots at folks, including folks in the Harlem Renaissance, like Langston Hughes. And really it was more an argument against sort of elitism and self-importance within the black community. But over the years, Schuyler would become the dominant voice of black conservative thought in America. And, you know, he was writing a syndicated column, and, you know, he was, you know, becoming the darling of, you know, the conservative establishment. And so, you know, he would begin to support McCarthyism, and, you know, and then he ultimately started critiquing Martin Luther King and wrote a scathing critique of Malcolm X, and, you know, and he sort of lost his way and lost his rootedness within the black community. And in the later period of his life, he was a very bitter man. And he was largely read by and published by, you know, the John Birch Society and other ultra-right-wing conservative groups. But, you know, here was a man who viewed himself as an aspiring race man, as they called them in the 20th century, race men. But by his death, he was relegated to the margins of the black community. And it's a sad and tragic tale about, you know, sort of what the excesses of political ideology can do to a person.
Yeah. Let's take another call. Our guest this afternoon on the program, Christopher Alan Bracey, author of Saviors or Sellouts, The Promise and Peril of Black Conservatism, From Booker T. Washington to Condoleezza Rice. This is The Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Let's take a call now from a listener in Champaign County. Line one, hi.
Hi. I wanted to say some things about the two bookends of your title, subtitle there. Booker T. Washington opposed the formation of the NAACP, which a lot of people don't remember, happened after a attack on a sort of a black bourgeois neighborhood in Springfield, Illinois, after the usual accusations of something untoward vis-a-vis a white woman. And it was really unleashed this resentment at this established community. They attacked and Booker T. Washington, you would think, would be sympathetic to you know, this constituency, as it were, but he may have, you know, you're going to say, I anticipate your answer saying that he just preferred a different approach. Now, on Condi Rice, the fact that she was on the chair, on the board of Chevron, and she had something, some kind, I don't know what the exact title was, but it had something to do with, you know, their social policies. You know, corporations want to be seen as not just out for the money and being good actors in the world. That's not really the authentic right-wing line, but a lot of corporations do have that kind of thing. While she was on that board, Chevron was involved in dispossessing and killing people in Nigeria. Chevron, there's a great documentary that won a Polk Award called Drilling and Killing in Nigeria. It's a radio documentary. One can Google that and probably find it and listen to it. There's good documentation that this was going on, and she didn't say anything about it. And so I just see that as, I understand your argument. You don't want to use something as an epithet, but I prefer to just talk about the specifics, and I think those are both very they're very damning, actually.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree. I mean, you know, that's why I say the promise and peril of black conservatism. You know, with Booker T. Washington, it was clear that he took some policy positions that, you know, undermined the black community, hurt black people. There's no doubt about it. I mean, when he encouraged black people not to vote, for instance, not to pursue the right to vote, he was in effect saying that it's okay to be a second class citizen, right? And you should get comfortable with that. And it took that created a lot of momentum in the South for disenfranchisement through terroristic acts by the Klan and, you know, the Knights of the White Camellia and so on and so forth. So there's no doubt that Booker T. Washington took positions that were deeply troubling, and the same with Condoleezza Rice. You know, the Chevron is just but one example. I mean, there are other positions that she's taken. I mean, think about her role as the apologist for the Bush debacle in New Orleans following Hurricane Katrina. You know, how could she possibly apologize for that and defend the Bush administration policy there? You know, unbelievable suffering that occurred right there on our televisions. We all saw it. And it didn't take place in another continent either. And yet, you know, both figures, I think, also represent some interesting sympathetic qualities. You know, Booker T. Washington was one who, although he publicly opposed, the right to vote for African Americans, he quietly supported litigation and financed litigation for people who were seeking the right to vote in jurisdictions where the right to vote would have triggered less overt hostility among whites. And for Condoleezza Rice, I mean, I think it's important to understand that, you know, although she seems almost imperialistic in her conservative views, that, you know, she grew up in Birmingham, Alabama. I mean, she knew Bull Connor, you know, fairly well, you know, and, you know, she is also a woman who is on record as supporting affirmative action and as pro-choice. So you know, even, you know, if you sort of take the most damning instances with respect to both of these candidates, those damning instances are not sufficient to dismiss them entirely. That, you know, these are complex political figures, both of them, and they really do represent both pitfalls but also possibilities.
Well, the two examples you gave for Condi on her behalf are something that she has done nothing about. And what she has done is what you've described and I described, and being apologist for the attack on Iraq, et cetera. So, you know, it's fine to have that in your soul, I suppose, but if you don't actually do anything, it doesn't, in my mind of weighing their pluses and minuses, it's fine that she's pro-choice, it's fine if she's for pro-affirmative action, but she's a figurehead in an administration that finds both of those antithetical. So,
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think ultimately, you know, if you say that what matters is actual conduct, you know, well, you know, you got to keep in mind that, you know, as a figure within the current Bush administration, she's deeply constrained. And so you should be sympathetic towards her for that reason, that, you know, she is compromised, and that, you know, if she had it her way, perhaps she would do something different. We don't know. But again, you know, this book that I've written, Saviors or Sellouts, is not necessarily an attempt to categorize individual conservative thinkers or actors. It is an attempt to get sight of the ideas that motivate these individuals and demonstrate that the world of ideas in which they're circulating, these conservative ideas, has a lifeblood of its own, and that it's sort of a rich and complex tradition that is often undervalued.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest today, Christopher Allen Bracey. He's a professor of law and of African and African-American studies at Washington University in St. Louis. He's the author of Saviors or Sellouts, The Promise and Peril of Black Conservatism, from Booker T. Washington to Condoleezza Rice. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with a question, a comment. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455. We have about 10 minutes remaining in this portion of the program. Well, let's go back 25 years to 1980. I guess it's more than 25 years now, to the Fairmont Conference. You write that most commentators identify this as a critical moment in the new outside approach to black conservatism. What was the Fairmont Conference, and why is it so critical?
Yeah, the Fairmont Conference was this sort of critical moment. You know, when you think back to the story in some ways begins before 1980. You know, by the close of the civil rights era, so we're talking about the late 60s, early 70s, the majority of black voters were encouraged by civil rights legislation and the sustained economic relief brought about by President Johnson's Great Society Initiative. So they had become liberal, and they were supporting the Democratic Party. Traditional black conservatives, those that were sort of like the Washingtonian-style black conservatives, family values, you know, sort of religious conservatives, they sort of endured this period quietly, and they sort of hung out, but had a low profile. And that was until this new group of black conservatives rose to public prominence. And you're right, there's a sort of big difference between traditional black conservatives and this new breed, whereas the traditional black conservatives were organic leaders that emerged and were supported from within the black community. This modern black conservative cohort emerged outside the black community, largely as a result of backing by white conservative elites. And the decisive moment was this Fairmont Conference, which was organized by Ed Meese, who was then head of the Reagan administration's transition team. And the Reagan administration had a new policy that it wanted to implement with respect to American race relations, and it no longer wanted to do business with the civil rights establishment. And so it wanted to identify a new cadre of black leaders who would subscribe to and support the Reagan administration's conservative policy for racial empowerment. That is, opposing quotas, opposing affirmative action, opposing set-aside contracts, you know, harsh law enforcement, the sort of usual issues. And so when you look at this conference, you have to ask yourself, well, who were the attendees? And it turned out that some of the attendees included Clarence Thomas, Clarence Pendleton, Thomas Sowell, Tony Brown, and the list goes on and on, actually. And the interesting thing is that during this conference, each one of these figures was called upon to basically demonstrate their bona fides, their support of the Reagan administration. And in response, at the end of the conference, Ed Meese said that he would deliver appointments. And, you know, basically, you know, appointments in the administration, but also appointments in conservative think tanks to those African-Americans who wanted to participate in this transformation that he imagined. And so the Clarence Pendletons and the Clarence Thomases and Thomas Sowells and Tony Browns were joined by Glenn Lowry, Shelby Steele, and others. And they would be situated not in the public sector, but in private think tanks. And that's what generated the intellectual grist of black conservatism in the modern era, this sort of black neoconservatism. And it was through the inorganic support networks that these black neoconservatives were summarily legitimated through the bestowal of government largest private funding and national public exposure, meaning their articles were placed in leading journals like the Wall Street Journal and Washington Times. Their books were published and put on the shelves and backed by publishing houses. I mean, this was a dramatic moment, and it really did change black politics forever.
Let's take another call. A listener in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Yes, I was just want to say I've very much been enjoying the broadcast today. But, you know, I had a question, and this is kind of going towards affirmative action. And this is something I consider myself to be a rather progressive individual. But I can't help but see a policy like affirmative action as almost laying a governmental establishment for racism, where it says, okay, you're equal, but we're going to separate you out. Shouldn't it? What are your feelings on affirmative action? Should it not be something more where if someone needs the economic aid, we provide that to them as a government, but let the grades and abilities of the student be determined rather than their race be the determining factor?
Well, you know, it's interesting that you raised the affirmative action question because, you know, conservatives, you know, tend to be staunchly opposed to affirmative action measures, but for a variety of different reasons, right? There's no sort of one reason why black conservatives are opposed to affirmative action. I mean, one of the big reasons that black conservatives are opposed to affirmative action is that, for the reason that you suggest, which is that it is sanctioning state-sponsored discrimination. Right, you're distinguishing or discriminating candidates based upon race, and that you're giving goods, right? Usually, some sort of benefit to people because of their race, and that's discrimination. And our Constitution, at least in theory, is supposed to be colorblind or at least neutral with respect to race. And so that's one argument that they raise. But Clarence Thomas makes a different argument. Right, Clarence Thomas has argued that affirmative action actually hurts African Americans, the recipients, because it stigmatizes them. It stigmatizes them as the sort of perennial objects of charity, and it doesn't allow them to sort of declare their competence on their own. That whatever positions that African Americans assume in American life, it always has an asterisk next to it, right? Because you never know whether or not they got that position based upon their own individual effort or because they've gotten some assistance. So that's a second, very different argument that you often hear that opposed, you know, against affirmative action. The critique of the conservative position on affirmative action is essentially twofold. The first is that black conservatives tend to underemphasize the power of race in structuring and determining life more generally in America. That we have a history of racial discrimination that dates back since the founding of this country. It's instantiated within all of our laws. It's in the Constitution as well. And you have century after century of racial subordination, so that racism becomes naturalized within the American landscape, cultural landscape, and that if you don't intervene affirmatively, all you will do is perpetuate whatever racial disparities have already existed. Because you'll never, I mean, if you treat people equally with an unequal start, right, you'll never be able to make up that difference, that shortfall. And so affirmative action is a response, as it were, to a history of racial discrimination, and that conservatives don't give that argument enough voice. They don't ventilate that argument enough.
Yeah. I want to thank the listener for his call. We're really running up against the clock now. Last question here to close. You say in the book that if we fail to recognize black conservatism as an intellectual movement, that's a failure with particularly tragic consequences. What does it cost us?
Yeah, I mean, it costs us a lot. I mean, the first thing that it costs us is, you know, we have to keep in mind that these were African-American thinkers and political actors that were trying to develop a distinct political consciousness designed to promote black success in the face of tremendous obstacles. And if you fail to recognize black conservatism as this intellectual movement, it is denying the intellectual and human agency of these people, and it is unnecessarily denigrating their historic efforts to help blacks lead fulfilling and self-directed lives. The second thing that is tragic about it is that if we don't recognize black conservatism as this intellectual movement with a rich and complex tradition, we are reinforcing the essentialized view of African Americans as a liberal cultural and political monolith. And it's just a lie. It's not true. There's intense diversity within black political thought and within the black community. And, you know, we don't need to be in the business of replicating stereotypes, even if it's for liberal purposes, right? Even if it's for an empowering reason. And then the third reason why I think we need to take seriously this idea of black conservatism as an intellectual movement or thought is because otherwise, we can't fully understand why there is a Condoleezza Rice or a Colin Powell or a Clarence Thomas. Why is it that our predominant public faces are conservative? How do they get here? How can we comprehend them, number one? But number two, how can we do business with them, right? If we're serious about, I mean, and I think this is true. If you're a liberal and you're committed to social justice matters, you have to take seriously the idea that blacks are becoming increasingly conservative, and you're going to have to do business with conservative blacks if you want to resolve any of these issues that are currently confronting black Americans. And you ignore black conservatism at your own peril if you do so.
Yeah, there we have to leave it. Christopher Bracey, thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Christopher Allen Bracey is the author of Saviors or Sellouts, The Promise and Peril of Black Conservatism from Booker T. Washington to Condoleezza Rice. The book is published by the Beacon Press.